Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. You know, this week we're going to do something a little bit different.
And now for something completely different.
I think, you know, now and again we need a break from politics. It's a political show, but sometimes you need a break. And it's a holiday. Maybe you don't want to think about how bleak everything still is. Looking forward to a year of ridiculous investigations into Hunter Biden's caravan full of rainbow fentanyl or whatever from the House. So this week we're going to talk about ancient civilizations in North America. And we're just going to jump right in. Something different for your holidays. Have a happy Thanksgiving or whatever you celebrate. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then come right back. Welcome back. Friends, I sometimes have trouble sleeping, and I recently stumbled over a great sleep aid. It was a lecture series on ancient Egypt, right? The professor was a British guy, which is always great for sleeping. I actually used to look for nature documentaries. Boring. The more boring, the better, with a British guy. He had a mellifluous voice, and I don't know, at least 50% of each lecture was just a list of, like, pharaohs begetting other pharaohs. So he'd be like, and it was all very hard to understand names. It was like Hatshepsut had a male son called Khufetsu, and Khufetsu's sister was blah blah blah, and on and on. And it put me right out. So I thought I had discovered this great sleep aid until I tried what I thought would be a similar series. It was a series of lectures by my next guest, and it was about ancient civilizations of North America, and it ruined my plan. Because it was totally engrossing, sucked me right in, and I ended up having to listen to the rest of it at the gym, where I listen to things to make the time fly by. So I am very happy to be joined by Dr. Edward Barnhart. Dr. Barnhart is an archaeologist and the director of the Maya Exploration Center. The series that got me hooked was one of several he has at the Great Courses website. You can check that out. It was titled Ancient Civilizations of North America. He also hosts a podcast. Like everybody has a podcast. He does too. I just subscribed to it today. It's called the Archeo Ed Podcast, which is spelled just like archaeology, but you lop off the Logi and stick Ed there. So Archeoed Podcast. And you can get that at archeoed.com or just search for it wherever you get your podcasts. Edwin Barnhart, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. The reason that I wanted to do a show with you is because I was a little embarrassed by how little I knew about our own pre-European history. I consider myself a relatively well-educated person. I even took some units of archaeology in college, but I had no concept of how diverse the pre-colonial civilizations in North America were and how large some of these communities were and how sophisticated these societies were in many cases. And I want to come back in a little bit to why that is, why we as a society are kind of detached from this history. But before we do that, and we're going to have to bounce back and forth a little bit, I wanted to start off with a hook, this mental image, which sucked me into your lecture series. And that is pyramids in North America. Pyramids whose foundations were similar in size to the Great Pyramids in Egypt. And I've visited Teotihuacan in Mexico and seen some smaller pyramids in Tulum, but I never knew that we had these great pyramids here in North America. What happened to them? What do we know about these structures?
Well, I'm glad you asked. It's my favorite topic.
That's why I had you.
So they are made of a different material, and now they look lumpy, but they are definitely pyramids, and there's a lot of them. I mean, you know, not all of them are the size of Giza, but collectively, we still have really thousands of pyramids around, especially the eastern part of the United States. But they were made of earth, not of stone, so time has not been kind to them, and they look kind of like lumpy salt licks now. But we know that they had clay caps in their heyday, and they looked very much from the surface like something that had been stuccoed over. So it did have that formal look, and they are pyramids. And it is kind of an amazing group amnesia we have as a nation that we drive right by these things now and don't see them for what they are. I mean, one of them is 2 miles from downtown St. Louis, and it's 100 feet high and covers the area of multiple football fields, and yet people don't even know it exists, even people living in St. Louis. So don't feel bad that you didn't know this. It's a weird group amnesia we all have.
Were these burial chambers?
Some of them were, but definitely not all of them. The tradition lasts a very long time. It's again, thousands of years from the origins to, you know, the biggest heights, but some of them are big-time burial mounds with hundreds of people in them. Other ones are actually just bases for elevated palaces and temples.
And we're going to have to bounce back and forth, as I said. Let's go back very briefly to the beginning. And again, I hope listeners check out your series, because there's no way we can do anything more than kind of scratch the surface here in less than an hour. But when I was in school, we learned it was a pretty simple story about the origins of humankind in North America. We learned that hunter-gatherers first populated the Americas by migrating over a land bridge from Asia, a land bridge that has since disappeared with rising sea levels. And that was about 12,000 years ago, 14,000 years ago. And it seems like there's a lot more controversy around that now, or maybe that controversy existed when I was learning about this in school, but they made it simple for the textbooks. What do we know, and what do we kind of hypothesize about how North America was first populated at this point?
Well, the part of the story where the initial population goes across the Bering Strait when it's a land bridge, that's still pretty solid. There's always been detractors, and probably always will be, people that want to say it came from Africa or Europe or across the Pacific. But all the data really still does point through migration through that Bering Strait. The difference is that now we're beginning to really get proof that it happened multiple times, that 2, maybe 3 different times, separated by as much as 10,000 years, groups of humans came across when it was a land bridge and then got landlocked over here, did their thing, and then 10,000 years ago later it happened again, and another group came through. So we have these interesting mixes of population that, thanks to the advent of DNA studies, we can now actually see that data through skeletal matter and also weird things like dried up poop. that we can get DNA out of, and we get this picture that it's much older than 12,000. I was in school probably about when you were, and that was the party line, that Clovis Man was the earliest we could detect at 12,000. But now we're seeing things that could be at 33,000 and even into the 40,000. That one's the real still hard to prove, but it does make a lot of dates that were thrown out 30 years ago as that must have been a bad carbon date. People are going back to them now and saying, wait a second, was that a bad carbon date, or are we just really wrong about what we think we know?
I'm learning things now. I didn't know that you could get DNA out of dried poop.
You really can. It's actually, you know, a dried poop is archaeological gold.
Okay. Oh, yeah. All right.
You think we're looking for gold. We're actually looking for poop these days.
Okay, Ed. So how far do we have to skip ahead? So we have these ancient, I assume, nomadic hunter-gatherers with very kind of rudimentary tools, right? That's who we're talking about 20,000 years ago.
Right, right. Hunter-gatherers. How like far the whole planet was.
Right. How far do we have to skip ahead to get to like permanent or semi-permanent settlements, the first of them?
Well, I'd say, you know, the conservative answer would be about 2000 BCE, so about 4,000 years ago. But depending on how you define settlement, we could pull that back really to almost 6,000 BCE in terms of semi-inhabited villages that would be depopulated at certain times of the year and then returned to. So kind of a serial sedentarism.
So and okay, there would be movements with seasonal movements?
Right. They're still hunter-gatherers, but they're recognizing, you know, they're gathering in bigger groups, working together, and they have things like a summer camp. You know, we're going to hang out by the river down here for the summer. And they build some things that are, you know, shelters. And then when the winter comes, they go back up into the mountains where they can hunt deer better.
Okay. And I was trying to think of how to organize this discussion in order to kind of, because again, we have to compress thousands of years of history into this rather brief conversation. And the way I thought, can you talk about how archaeologists delineate between different eras or different groups of ancient North Americans? And what kind of, is it, are there some technological innovations that help you think about different eras of ancient civilization?
Well, there's certainly, seemingly every year, a new technology tool we use, which is exciting. But the basics have been the basics for a long time. I mean, basically, you asked about two things, time and space.
Yes.
Time, how, you know, how old things are, that is really about stratigraphy, the thing that Thomas Jefferson was using in his backyard. Just the very basic concept that things that are buried deeper are older. So, it, you know, in a non-disturbed context, things over thousands of years get covered up with mulch and river floods and things like that, and they deposit in a, you know, from the top to the bottom fashion. So that's stratigraphy. That is probably the, you know, the primary building block of archaeology. Of course, it, you know, soil can get mixed up and we have to figure all that sort of stuff out. But in an actual deposit, that's it. And then, you know, we were doing that before we even were able to date through carbon-14, which only happened in like the 1950s. Now we can validate those layers and more fine-tunely date them, not just put them in chronological order, but actually sort out dates through things like carbon-14 and other dating things. Before we had that, ceramics was a huge part, and that's also about the space part. So, you know, over time, people's ideas of tools and ceramics and things change. So, you know, the lowest levels are all stone. Oh, nobody's figured out how to make pottery yet. Then we get up to a higher level. Oh, look, there's some pottery, but it's, you know, pretty rudimentary. And they're making these forms. Then you go up another layer and you say, oh, look, they're making better ceramics now. And they're involving, you know, fish hooks or something like that. So we see those, you know, those material changes over time, but those also spread out in space. So like if we're looking at, okay, where's the border of Pueblo culture and Hohokam culture in the Southwest? We look at things like ceramics. Okay, these guys make these kind of ceramics and these guys make those. And somewhere in the border between, there's a mix. But then the farther you get away from that border, it's more purely one culture or another's, you know, art. That's the way we divide one culture from another spatially.
I think a lot of Americans, I'm not speaking for everyone, but I think a lot of Americans have a sense of pre-colonial societies. We have an image that they tended to be live in smaller communities, be largely nomadic, and that was not the case in many of these civilizations. In fact, there were what can only be described as cities before Europeans came, which was another kind of revelation in your lectures. I never thought of big cities. Can you talk about some of the larger human settlements that have been discovered in North America and kind of give us a sense of what life was like back then?
Sure, we can
take city life, urban life.
Right. Okay, well, let me pick one. But let me say before that, too, that, you know, Europe started hunter-gatherers, too. It's not like, you know, they were cities for thousands of years before anybody in North America was doing anything. The, you know, the first communities, like I say, started, you know, 2000 BC. Like, for example, the really an enigmatically large city is the one sitting in northern Louisiana, in the bayous, in the swampy areas. There is a gigantic site called Poverty Point that has a pyramid, again, that's 100 feet tall, multiple football fields in size, called just boringly Mound A, but it was definitely built by 1700 BCE and continued to be used for centuries afterwards. And in front of it were these big kind of half arc auditorium looking platforms that had houses on them. And so people were living in those houses, a big plaza in between, other pyramid buildings and other settlements spread out along the river to a total of about 5,000 people. And so they were living there, but they didn't have ceramics. They hadn't developed ceramics yet. They hadn't developed any massive farming like corn. So they were just harvesting resources from the bayou, probably animals and plants, to eat and to gather. And then they were trading widely. So we have this city in Louisiana, of all places, that had a trade network, that had enough organizational power to support 5,000 people. That doesn't sound much in modern terms, but, you know, the city of Jericho had 5,000 people. So that was there's a, you know, a yardstick. So they were, you know, they were organized. They were building things. That those mounds didn't have any burials in them. So those were either about religion or some other kind of political process. Very organized, and they were trading up and down the Mississippi River as far as Ohio and New York. We find mica there from New York.
Do we know how things were transported?
By river is what we're assuming, though we've never found a boat. You know, they could have certainly done it by land.
How extensive were these trade networks? Because this is another thing that I think does not fit our image, that there were these large settlements trading according to their specialization, which is like basic economics, right? You had some communities had access to certain resources and I assume certain skills. Others had access to different resources and different skills, and they traded. How common was that?
Well, we probably will never know the full extent, but I can say in the case of Poverty Point, there are thousands of artifacts already found that are from hundreds of miles away. You know, as close as like Arkansas, there was some soapstone and some precious stone that they got from there. But they got stone from Ohio for sure, mica from New York. They've got, eventually at the end, they started getting clay objects and started making pottery. And we know that stuff came from Georgia. So those were all places that they were connecting to. A weird thing about Poverty Point is, though, when you go to those far out places like New York and Georgia, there are nobody's found any Pottery Point objects out there, or very few. So it seems a very one-way relationship for that big enigmatic city, that they're collecting things from afar. They're not necessarily selling their stuff. They're just collecting. At least that's how archaeology makes it look. The trouble with archaeology is, you know, we only have the view of the hole we dig, and right next to us could be the actual stuff. And it's just, you know, until we dig all of North America, we're just, these are all, you know, theories and working models.
I wonder if they were trading some sort of goods that don't leave a mark.
That's entirely possible, especially from a, you know, bayou, biodiverse area. The things they could have been traded were, you know, wood and baskets and things like that.
Right.
But certainly there was a trade relationship that went on then, but that was just the beginning. You know, if we turn the clock forward to about 1000 AD, then this flowering of cities starts, where there's these cities, each of them with multiple pyramid buildings inside and hundreds of homes that are surrounded by giant walls, like medieval English walls, but they're all made out of huge logs. So like Cahokia has a 2-mile perimeter around it, and each one of the trees that make up the posts of its wall are at least a foot in diameter and 14 foot maybe tall. So they're just giant, you know, walled cities. And by the time we get to maybe 1200, you know, there's at least 20 of them that we know very well, and a bunch of other ones that are just sitting on Kentucky farms and nobody cares about. So, I mean, it was not only a massive cities, but a lot of them, and a population in between of little hamlets and towns, just like Europe had. And they had their own little walls and temples and political structure and highways going between them. You know, some of them were just little country roads like we have, but between the big places, there were highways that that DeSoto reported were 50 feet across.
Wow. Wow. And do we have estimates of kind of how populous the biggest settlements were by the time we get to the 1200s?
Yes. Yes, we do. The one that we count as the largest is Cahokia, the one right next to St. Louis. Its population within just the city itself was somewhere between 20 and 30,000 people.
Okay.
So which is massive.
Yeah.
But if you take the little towns that are around it within a 10-mile radius, then the population of the area, like its metroplex,
yes,
is more like 50,000 people.
Okay, I'm very attuned to that because I live in a town that has officially like 28,000 people, and it's the county seat. And there's little towns all around that are part of this town, and we're really much bigger than that. So you've alluded to this a little bit. So I want to ask you more pointedly. To compare the relative, I don't know if sophistication is the right word, but I'll use it for lack of a better term. Can we compare the relative sophistication of North American civilizations in, I don't know, say the 14th century or whenever, pre-colonization, with those in Asia or Europe?
Yeah, I mean, we absolutely can. And, you know, that's kind of my professional life's mission, is to try to explain to people that on many of the metrics we find as, you know, civilized, the people of North America were on par with what everybody else was doing, especially if we take a date like the 1400s. You know, I think you sound a bit of a fan of history, me, though it puts you to sleep sometimes. I'm honored that I did not. You know, Europe was doing pretty stinking bad in the 1400s.
Yes, it was.
That was really, I mean, it was mostly just illiterate pig farmers swilling mead.
Well,
it was not. It was not a high society.
The 50% that survived.
Exactly. When they weren't dying of the diseases that they pretty much let continue unabated. So if we're going to talk about up into the 1400s, really, I should have started the other one. Since you saw my series, the other huge civilization was the American Southwest. Three different civilizations actually building in stone and building huge buildings. So, you know, let's level the playing field for North America a little bit by saying, let's talk about the Mississippian people that were the millions building the pyramids east of the Mississippi River, and then the American Southwest, where we had the Pueblo, the Hohokam, and the Mogollon. So those are our players in this scenario, right?
Yes.
Why do we count these other cultures as sophisticated? And I recognize I'm always on the defense because I'm Team North America.
No, I like this.
So let's talk about building and engineering, right? So, you know, building big buildings out of stone, building them architecturally sound so they don't fall down. You know, the pyramids are made of dirt, but they're huge and they did not fall down. They're still there. And then the stuff that was made in Chaco Canyon is just, you know, at the time, it is as fine. Actually, even just take away the time, any ancient civilization, their architecture is super sophisticated and wonderful. Those great houses in Chaco Canyon are, you know, any architect in the world looks at those and says, that is world-class stuff.
Yeah.
So we got, you know, we've got building for sure on par with the rest of the world. The Hohokam next door, they were hydraulic engineers like no one else at their time. The only other ones who did as well were the Inca. And they made over 700 miles of irrigation canals that were little and small and had engineering to push for kilometers into the desert around in between what's now Phoenix and Tucson. That whole area was turned into a green paradise like Egypt did to the Nile through over 700 miles of sophisticated irrigation canals. Big ones, big enough where a person could stand in them and look small. So there's some other engineering. I don't want to filibuster your show. But I'll also say astronomy.
They
were on par with any ancient culture and what they were thinking and how they were going about it. Mathematics, even when we look at the Hopewell culture before the Mississippians, those guys were crazy math nerds. They understood geometry. They understood how to measure things over huge distances, and they tied it all in. They made geometric forms that were aligned to astronomical phenomena. So in terms of their capacity for, you know, what we call scientific thought, well, they certainly also were not your average hunter-gatherer, in the image of, you know, Graham Hancock's lazy, simple people who don't think about math.
Right. The noble savages. Let's dig into that question. I mean, how did we come to have this very simple view of pre-colonial North America and the people who inhabited it? And the reason I asked this, well, many reasons I asked this, but the week before last, I was in Egypt, and it's very stark how different the relationship between modern Egyptians are to their ancient ancestors and the way we are. And obviously, the references to ancient Egypt are everywhere. Now, the obvious answer, the one that you usually get, is that history is written by the victors, Europeans, largely, you know, wiped out native societies, and that's certainly a big part of it. But is that all that it is?
Well, you know, that is definitely part of it. I mean, we, yes, from the beginning had an Indian problem, not a group to get along with and bond with. There was an adversarial relationship. And I do think in the early days, there was every attempt to minimalize their sophistication as a validation of Manifest Destiny.
Yes.
But that was generations ago, right? And it's not like this stuff got bowled over and hidden. It's still out there in plain sight. It's still in big parks all over the United States. And in a surprising amount of, you know, everybody lives pretty close to one of these things, at least on the East Coast. So we have collectively just kind of drank the Kool-Aid that these things are just insignificant, that they don't, you know, mean anything. There's people are more interested in learning about whether they were Atlanteans or giants than really investigating the actual history of the people that were in America before Europeans. But I don't want to call it a conspiracy theory or anything. It's not. No. Just at this point, generations in, we have just been conditioned to ignore it. It's like background noise somehow. It's bizarre to me, but that's where we're at. When I made that series, I thought that everybody would write me and say, I live near there, and here's the real story. You got it wrong. But instead, everybody wrote me and said, I've been living next to that for my whole life and didn't even know it. Thank you for telling me. I'm shocked. That's something I can actually look at and go see.
Yeah. That was my reaction. What was it about European colonization of North America that led to such different outcomes for the native people relative to European colonization of Africa or the Middle East or Asia, right? I mean, we had a genocide here, a pandemic here that wiped out much of the native population. And, you know, colonialism, I think, always featured brutality, but that wasn't necessarily the case elsewhere. Do we have a sense of what the differences were or why those why there were such disparate impacts?
Well, it really was the disease. It was, you know, a terrible, perfect storm of history where the Americas were a landlocked continent away from what we refer to as the old world. So, you know, as pandemics slowly developed over really thousands of years in the old world, they were able to transmit by land and animal, lots of pack animals that the Americas didn't have. And so they had some form of contact of a version of these diseases in ways that certainly ravished them, like the Black Plague. But those never touched the Americas until the contact. And when it did, you know, it wasn't just one disease. It was like five dormant diseases woke up in the first 50 years. And it wiped out conservatively 90% of the whole population, which was millions and millions of people. And that was more than just a population game. That was not just, you know, oh, now they've got less people to fight our army. It was a psychological game. It was an apocalypse. You know, the first generation, all the young people and the old people die. The old people can't teach anybody. There's no young people to teach. The ones in the middle are told to convert to Christianity or die. The disease to them was a supernatural spiritual attack. They didn't have an idea that diseases are biological. They were all conceived as spiritual to them. So, you know, psychologically, morally, everybody was scared and beaten down and anxious to jump on the bandwagon of being more European to save themselves. And within a single generation, you know, the brain dump was outrageous. The inspiration to adopt European ways and completely forget about their own ways was clear and present. And it was just a terrible storm. So, you know, it was the disease, but the disease triggered, you know, a moral, philosophical, and just cultural disaster that swept a lot of that knowledge out so fast nobody could even record it.
I struggle to even wrap my head around a disease wiping out 90% of the population. You know, and the Black Plague, the Black Death, the estimates are that 50% of the European population perished in the middle of the...
Which started at about 80 million. So like 40 million died.
And the estimates are that the population didn't recover until the 18th century, which is stunning to me. So hundreds of years, really, to get back that population. And of course, the Native American population has never recovered here. Before I let you go, Ed, I'm going to ask for some wild speculation. Just this is a question I've thought about. Have you ever given any thought to how these societies might have developed if the Europeans had arrived a couple of hundred years later?
Oh, just a little bit now
and again. Go off.
It is amazing to contemplate. I've often thought about, you know, various science fiction books I could write about, you know, what society would be like if the Aztecs and the Inca were world powers today.
Oh, I would totally read that, by the way.
Wouldn't it be the greatest? For one thing, their medicine would be totally different. It would be a hell of a lot more like church than a hospital. They would have continued this belief that there's another world that we can contact, and they would do all sorts of things through that. I've dreamed of things like there would be like shaman detective agencies. You could just go to the shaman and he would divine from the other world exactly where your missing wife is or something, you know?
Yeah.
And, the art would be totally different. Food, we did a good job of jerking that out of their hands. So we got all their food. we'd probably have a lot better and more mole recipes. That would be sure.
Yes.
But I also think that we love to talk about how violent these cultures were, again, to sort of validate European
violence
imposing on their culture. But they also had very, eloquent poems and beautiful art. I think that they would have, like we are still working on, evolve out of, sacrifice kind of mentality, and their arts, which were beautiful then, would have flowered into God knows what now.
It's really interesting to think about how they would have developed into modernity. Obviously, they would have started to have trading networks, just like people in other, in other continents did. We've all become interconnected in the intervening years. It's a really interesting kind of like
the president of experiment. Mexico would probably live on top of a pyramid.
Yeah. Oh, it's really fascinating. I'm grateful for you for bringing me this sophisticated understanding about the civilizations that preceded ours here in the Americas. Dr. Ed Barnhart, I believe we are out of time, but I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I am grateful.
This has been fun, Josh. Invite me another time. Happy to contribute.
I will. Folks, Ed's podcast is Archeo Ed. Also, do check out his lecture series. You can find it at thegreatcourses.com. I'd also like to thank David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Ross Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on various social media sites at this point. Check me out on Twitter. I actually have a list of all the different places where I'm cross-posting. And of course, I'd like to thank all of you fine people. Have a terrific week. Have a nice holiday. Punks out.